This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraja aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal, joining you from our Lexington, Kentucky studio. Thank you to everyone listening tonight on Sirius 220, XM 206, and to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. Now a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund, and the show you're about to listen to this evening is going to show you just how important the PDJF is. If you're interested in helping, visit pdjf.org for more information. And joining me tonight, a jockey who should be an inspiration to us all. Her determination, her focus, and her hard work have taken her many places. She faces her toughest challenge yet, but carries with her that same winning attitude. Jockey Anne Von Rosen, with 666 career wins, over $5 million in earnings, she's joining us this evening on Jock Talk. Anne, welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us, and I understand you have a very busy schedule. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to come on the show.
Oh, you know, you're more than welcome. It works out. Yes, I'm just as busy as I was before when I was riding. Now, just in a different way.
Sure. Well, tell us what your day holds for you today. Tell us what keeps you busy.
Well, today I've already been at physical therapy for 2 hours. So with a drive, it takes me half an hour to drive there, and I'm there for 2 hours. And half an hour back, so I just got back about half an hour ago. And then I have another therapy. It's called Girotonic, which I just started this afternoon. So this is like my lunch break, and then I'm off on the road again. But actually, I had a pretty good day today so far. Physical therapy went well, and I'm excited. It was good. It's always motivating when therapy goes good and the therapists are happy and they see the progress more than I do.
Well, of course.
So that helps.
You mentioned, and I'll probably pronounce this wrong, but you mentioned Girotonics? I don't know what that is.
I didn't either. It's also too with neurological stuff. It's a lot of also Z Health. Different stimulations like on my legs, like we do heat and ice, see if my legs react and scratching and just, poking and little sharp and dull instruments on my feet and my legs to see what reaction we get, if we get any reaction. And, which is good because they do react, actually.
Really?
My legs. My brain doesn't always register it yet, but in a way I can feel stuff. So my sensation has gotten a little bit better. Because before I had like zero sensation or motor skills from my chest down, basically just below from my nipple area down, there was just nothing. I mean, zip. So now I can move my hips and my pelvis, and I actually have a little bit of sensation in my abs too. But deep sensation, still nothing to touch, but like if somebody like really kind of hits me, and well, not hits hard, but hitting the stomach or the back or my legs, my thighs, I can feel it.
Wow, that has to be so promising, because here we're coming up on 2 years since your accident, and you have, again, as I said in the introduction, your determination, your dedication to to being able to feel again, to walk again one day. I mean, it's incredible to read about everything you've done. That has to be so satisfying to have just even as slight as that might be, that slight feeling you get in your abs and your hips. That has to be such a good feeling.
Oh, yes, it is, definitely. And it's encouraging, even though it's still frustrating to me because it's very slow, the progress, and it's you know, hard work, and I don't always see the progress because I work on it every day, and it's just so minute that I don't really notice it, and I always expect more of what I'm doing.
Sure.
And, like, the muscles, they just don't come back as quick, like, as if you were to work out, you know, you just don't feel it. Not there because the nerves aren't all connected, or not at all, a little bit, or they're just trying to come back. So it just takes way longer than, you know, I ever thought. I mean, I never even thought it was, you know, I don't know. I was always determined I was going to walk again, so I just didn't think it was going to take this long.
Patience.
Well, because I had no idea, really, you know. I didn't know what, you know, the spinal cord injury all entails and what it is. Is really, because you don't really, not having, knowing anybody or having to deal with anybody that's had it, you just don't really know what it all entails until you're there.
And Anne, really, you're able to get around pretty well these days. You're pretty mobile from what I saw. I saw a video, actually, I think it was on your Facebook wall, of, describe to our listeners what I'm talking about. I don't want to give it away.
I don't know which one, like, oh, when I was walking on the...
Yes.
Walker. Yes, well, I started off with, last year, with braces that went from, well, all leg braces. They still had a trunk support. So I had, like, this belt around my trunk that would, you know, support my trunk, and then they had, you know, leg braces on either side. So a year ago, we took off the trunk part. So I only had a brace for the right leg and the brace for the left leg that went all the way up my thigh. And then I walked because my trunk was, you know, I was getting more stable. And then I walked with those for all year, really, pretty much, or practice walking. And then this year, then now we moved down to braces that were just from the knee down. So it's another step forward. And it's just, my right leg is stronger. My right leg can support it. My left leg is not always quite there yet. Like walking, my knee, left knee wants to buckle still. And it's just, but I just got to keep practicing, you know. A lot of it is just, unfortunately, repetition for the brain to recognize it again. And so it can build new pathways. But no, it's I'm glad I got rid of the big braces. They're kind of awkward. So I got the little ones now. And actually now they have me walking on the treadmill. In therapy, which I really love. It's great. Yeah. I'm in a harness, so I can't go anywhere. I'm kind of, you know, it helps supporting me, but I can walk a lot further on the treadmill when it's less strenuous because I don't have to support myself so much with my arms because the harness is supporting me. And also just because I can walk more and further. And it's more like a walking motion on the treadmill than it is on the walking with a walker. So it feels more natural. And I think my brain recognizes it more, too. So it's easier to get into a rhythm, like a walking rhythm, if you understand. I don't know.
No, that makes, excuse me, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So today I walked, actually, I did walk a quarter mile in 28 minutes. So I'm pretty
excited.
It's the furthest I've ever walked.
Well, that is fantastic, and I am so excited. The future is so bright for you. You are just so determined, and it's so inspirational to me, and I'm sure to all of our listeners who are joining us tonight as well. Do you remember that first time back when you had the bigger, bulkier braces, but do you remember the first time when you actually stood up and were able to move with the aid of the braces and the walker?
Yeah, that was pretty incredible. Just being able to stand up, you know, it was pretty incredible. It was just, you know, it's just weird because it's like you try and move and you can't feel it. Like, I still have no feelings in my legs. You know, they move forward, but I can't really feel them. It's like, it's, you know, so it's really weird, you know, moving your legs without being able to feel them. or where they're going. So where you're placing you. It's an amazing feeling, that's for sure. Especially first time being, you know, standing up, and especially after what I was told that, you know, all of, you know, I would never be able to do that. So
what were you told exactly?
Well, I don't think the surgeon ever told me, but several people told me that the second surgery was just to make me comfortable in a wheelchair, basically, because I messed myself up pretty good. So my injury was pretty severe. And but somehow I don't know, I never really listened to it, or I guess I just blocked it out, because I just did, you know, right from the start, even when I was still in ICU, I said, you know, I'll be fine. I don't know how, but I'm going to be fine. So I think that helped a lot mentally, that I never really let it sink in that there was, you know, I wasn't, you know, basically meant to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life. So, and then I'm lucky also that my parents have been very supportive. My father's a physician in Germany, and he said, you know, for me to, you know, having treatments and stuff, and great treatment place in Puerto Rico, great doctor who's helped me a lot. And I don't think I would be as far along as I am without his treatment, honestly. So, and it just speeds it up. And it gives me confidence, too, you know, and motivation, because he's treated enough. He's been doing this treatment for 20 years, and he's treated a lot of paralyzed people before and has helped them, I mean, successfully. So it's... That's very, you know, it just gives you, you know, I trust him and confidence and what he's doing, and that I can overcome this.
And you mentioned your positive thinking, and I think that is so important in everything we do in life. And as you know, even during your riding career, if you don't go out there on a 50-to-1 shot with that positive way of thinking, well, you're not going to win even before you get on the horse. So you're well aware of how to develop that mindset of that positive thinking. But I can't imagine being in that position. How do you keep that every day?
It's hard. I don't know. It's hard because I have my days. You know, it's just like, I don't know, you know, things. I mean, it's weird if people think you're paralyzed or you shouldn't feel anything. Well, no, we do. I mean, we've got a lot of pain and things going on inside my body, which I'm sure is good, but it's very uncomfortable and painful, like burning and itching, and the spasticity gets really bad at times. But I also think it's a good thing. But and then when things aren't going very good, I get very frustrated and depressed. But, you know, like I'm actually, you know, I'm fortunate I was a jockey and an athlete, because it's sure helping me now, because, like, you know, you're not going to give up. Same with when riding, you know. Things don't go right, you're not doing well, you're not winning, but you got to keep going. And eventually things are going to turn around again. It's going to go in your favor. So you know, we all have bad days and an off day and stuff. And then things are going to pick up and turn around, and you get on a winning streak instead of a losing one. So
you're on your way. Excuse me. You're on your way to a winning streak, and that's no doubt in my mind at all. And what do you do on those days when you're feeling down and you're just kind of depressed, I suppose? What do you do to improve your attitude? Do you call your father? Do you?
I talk to my parents every day anyway, so then they know. And then I just kind of, I'm just kind of do something, and, you know, I just keep going, keep doing what I'm doing. You know, maybe if the walking isn't going good, I'm not going to walk as much or just a little bit, and then do something else. I have a mat here, and I can do exercises on, or I go to the gym and do a little bit in the gym or something. I'm always doing something, like from before too. I'm not very good at sitting still. Well, that's kind of
former jockey. I mean, I understand.
Yeah, exactly. So I always got to do something, and then days go by so quick, and there's so much I got to work on. It's not just the walking, but there's so much you have to build up, you know, like all the muscles. There's so many muscles that have to work together just to do something. So, and you don't realize until you don't have them anymore. And it's really scary. You know, so many things you take for granted, like even just, you know, sitting up and I don't know, anything. You know, I couldn't even do that in the beginning.
Wow.
You know, I mean, and I was really in the hospital. I couldn't even cough because of my diaphragm, because it wasn't working.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, they had to, like, literally help me to cough, like, physically. So, I mean, it's just silly stuff like that you don't ever think about.
Wow.
So, but now, I mean, that's working again now, thank goodness. But there's just so many things that I've got to retrain and reprogram. And so my day's always filled doing something. Plus, everything takes so much longer now, even just getting up and getting out of bed and getting ready. It's you know, just you got to schedule your day accordingly. Not like before, you can just jump out of bed and get dressed and get out the door in 20 minutes.
I'm not a very patient person, man. I get road rage like you wouldn't believe. I can't imagine how patient you have to be with yourself in the whole process.
You learn. You got it. I wasn't. I'm not either. But you learn. Yeah, I lost, like, yeah, you use your patience. Last, yeah, especially when, you know, progress seems to be slow and I get impatient. But you have to learn. There's nothing you can, you know, there's nothing you can do. It's the way it is. And it's like, you know, getting angry or upset or impatient, it's not going to help you in the long run. So, like you said, you know, I think, when to everything is in the mind, if you think positive, because your body reacts to your thoughts, I think, and what you're thinking. Actually, yeah, I think the whole everything around you too, you know, like it's eventually if you keep being positive and but you have to really believe it too, you know, not just say it. You have to, like, really believe in it. And you learn.
So, for us to understand exactly how far you have come, tell us, when you first got to the hospital following your accident, how long did you have to stay in the hospital, and what was your condition? What did you fracture? What was the condition?
I fractured. Actually, I burst fractured my fifth thoracic vertebrae. And so that's like middle of your chest. And I fractured T4-2, which is one above. They actually, the same day, had to do emergency surgery because I was leaking spinal fluid and basically clear out the mess because, like, T5 was pretty much smashed. I mean, it was just like bone fragments everywhere. So that was on the same day of my injury, an 8-hour surgery. And then 2 days later, I had another surgery where they stabilized my spine from T2 through to T7. And actually, they replaced T5 is now a titanium plate.
Wow.
And they had to, basically, because there was nothing left of it. So,
wow.
And yeah, if you see the x-rays of what my back looks like now, it's pretty horrific. I mean, there's a lot of hardware.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot of stuff going on. So, and like I said earlier, I couldn't sit up on my own and couldn't cough. I mean, I'm lucky I still have a complete use of my arms and hands and fingers. So, but just your whole balance thing is just gone, you know. I mean, everything's gone from your chest down. There's like nothing there, you know. It's just, it's weird. And I was in John C. Lincoln here in Phoenix for just over 2 weeks, I guess. And then I went to a rehab center in Colorado, a clinic, but I didn't like it there. And then my parents flew me home to Germany, and I went to a rehab clinic there near, close to home from April till September. September. And then I went to Puerto Rico for treatment for 2 months. And in November of 2014, I came back to Phoenix. And then I just did, like, outpatient rehab. So it's been quite the journey.
I would say.
Sure.
I would say so. And you mentioned your father and your parents in Germany, and I would love to discuss that with you, how you grew up, and we'll get to that. But your father specializes in holistic medicine, if I read correctly.
Yeah.
What did he do
a
to help you?
Doctor. I think it's his whole mindset, and that he doesn't, you know, Well, he didn't know anything about, you know, spinal cord injuries either, but he just always has a different approach on things. And his whole mindset, well, that's where I get it from, too. My parents, like, his positive thinking. And but there are other ways, you know, like here at the rehab center, they pretty much, they physical therapy is good, but they get you independent in the wheelchair. So they can go out in the world in the wheelchair. And that's not what I wanted. You know, yes, I want to be independent, but I want other stuff too. There's got to be other stuff out there. At least try it, that you can you walk again, that helps you walk again. So, and that's part of the reason also why I went to Germany, because my father, you know, I could, he could pick me up from the rehab center and take me here and take me there, and I could go home on the weekend. So the whole atmosphere was just nicer. And also, that's how he's, through him, that, you know, he found through a colleague, this doctor in Puerto Rico, who does this special treatment. It's called electroneuromedullotherapy, which is, he needles right onto the dura, which is the skin surrounding the spinal cord. And then he stimulates it electrically, because, like, the nervous system is like an electric circuit. So it's all got to do with electricity, but that's how he kind of stimulates the nerves. And it's working. I mean, I'm 100% convinced that it's working and it's helped.
Wow.
It has helped me for sure. And he has people there, like, from the States, and there was me, and from South America and stuff, and people that are off a lot worse than me too. So,
of course. I saw a picture of, I believe you were in the ocean in Puerto Rico. Does that help you, water therapy?
Oh, yes. Yes, it does, for sure. And then, like, in the beginning, I had to do floaties and noodles because I wasn't strong enough to swim, but now I can swim on my own without any swimming aid. It sure does, especially salt water and all the minerals in there. And it, and like I said, also, like, you know, it's nice atmosphere. And I used to do, you know, in the, like, just on the edge of the water where it's shallow, I could, you know, do some exercises in the water and stuff. And, yeah, now water therapy is really good. And I could practice walking in the pool. That's how I started to, you know, through it. And it's, you know, and like, like I said, the salt water especially, it's really good. It helped my spasticity too. It was less when I used to go in there.
Well, I got to tell you, Ann, I can't swim. So I think that's amazing that you are now able to swim on your own. That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. But,
I read something else that apparently your father did with you. Raindrop therapy. I don't know what that is.
It's essential oils. It's young living oils that are really very good from, like, the way they collect them. And because all different, I don't know too much about it either, but all the different essential oils have a frequency in themselves also. And then you'd get them, they... on the soles of your feet, just like, because you know, your whole body's on the soles of your feet too, you know, like, you know, from feet reflex zone, and every part of the sole of your foot relates to a part in your body, so it does get absorbed in your body. And so I have those oils. I had those done when I was in Germany. I haven't had it yet, and it's just, they used to put on the feet and then down my spine, obviously where the nerves come out either side. So, and if anything, you know, it's always, you know, having your feet massaged is nice and relaxing too. And it also, it hits a lot of certain parts of your body. And there are, like, acupuncture points down there too, which I think everything comes together. I never know really what works better, best. I think there's just so many things and they come together and they work together.
The combination of everything. And I have to tell you, I fractured my C6, my neck, several years ago, and acupuncture was the best thing I've ever experienced.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, it helps. I had some done in Germany too, like acupressure massage and acupressure and electroacupuncture. So I haven't had it since I've been here, but I did in the beginning. And they reacted, like my legs reacted to it, which is really weird. So, I mean, it's good. You know, something is still working and they are trying to.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And Jockey Ann Von Rosen joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And we just have a couple minutes before the break, but, and I don't want to bring back bad memories. I don't want to take you to a bad place, but do you remember anything about the accident?
No, I don't. I got knocked out. All I remember is, like, I was so excited after the race because she ran really big race, and I was all happy. And then the next thing I knew, I was lying on the ground, and I couldn't feel my legs, basically. And then I was in and out of consciousness. So however she fell, and she knocked me out. And also my face apparently was, like, black and blue after, so I must have just went forward on her neck, and that knocked me out. Mm. So, of course, yeah, I had quite the bruises in my face, as I was told.
And it was after the race when you were pulling the horse up, correct?
Yeah, after the race at the three-quarter pole. It's just one of those freaky things, I guess. And, like, you know, also a lot of times when they stumble, they give you a little bit of a warning. It was nothing. I mean, she never, like, even took a bad step before or anything. She just went, boom. Mm. I don't know. So,
and it was a quarter horse, yes?
Yeah. Yes, it was. And she was fine. So, and I know she was sound because, I mean, I've ridden her before and there's nothing wrong with her. So I don't know. It's just one of those freaky things that happen, I guess, unfortunately. Well, I got lucky. I got very lucky. Could have been a lot worse.
You are very lucky, Anne. And we'll continue our visit with jockey Anne Von Rosen after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. First, let's head to Southern California, where Rafael Bejarano continued to extend his lead in the jockey standings at Santa Anita. Bejarano consistently came in the money on 55% of his mounts and finished the week with 8 wins, 2 seconds, and 2 third place finishes. Javier Castellano had another solid week at Gulfstream Park as he won 37% and came in the money on 63% of his mounts. Castellano finished the week with 10 wins, 3 seconds, and 4 third place finishes. The Ortiz brothers have been dominating at Aqueduct, and this week was no exception. Irad won the Grade 3 Gotham Stakes aboard Chagoff and finished in the money on 60% of his mounts. For the week, Irad finished with 5 wins, 7 seconds, and 4 third place finishes. Finally, our Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Jose Ortiz, led the nation in wins and now leads the Aqueduct rider standings by 3 over his brother Irad. On Sunday, Jose swept the early pick 3 and came back a few races later to win races 7 and 8. Ortiz finished the week with 11 wins, 2 seconds, and 3 third place finishes. Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, is the perfect book for anyone who has wondered what it takes to be a professional jockey. The sport's most prominent jockeys and trainers tell their stories and share their insights on all that goes on behind the scenes. A significant portion of the proceeds go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. For excerpts, testimonials, and to order, visit JockeyTalk360.com. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all of the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Anne Von Rosen. And before we went to the break, Anne, we were talking about your injury and the strides you have made in progress towards walking again, your eventual goal. And you mentioned your father and how he's helped with your therapy, and you mentioned that he's from Germany, and as we would say around here in Kentucky, you're not from around these parts. You have an accent. I'm assuming you grew up in Germany.
Yes, I did. I was born and raised in Germany, and it's been like, I went to school in England when I was 15 for 3 years. It was only meant to be like one of those exchange things for a year, but then I was going to go back to Germany, and my school told me, well, if you come back now, you have to go a year back in class. You know, and I'm like, hell no, I'm not going to do an extra year in school. So I stayed in England. I finished my school there. So, and then I returned to Germany and actually started an apprenticeship in breeding and husbandry on a thoroughbred stud farm near Frankfurt, and which I really enjoyed. It was fun. It's a college course. It's practical, and you get to go to college too. And then. And I went back to England and worked in Epsom, worked some babies, or trained in Epsom, Epsom Downs. I've been around them. And basically because I thought, you know, after doing the breeding and getting the foals on where they go after that, you know, go to the racetrack and be race horses. So I wanted to learn that. I went to England and I went to France, to Chantilly, and I worked in Italy. So... the race horses, which it was really good, very interesting, and it's different, and I got to see great places with some nice people, and I worked for some good trainers, and also then I went back to Germany too because my parents weren't really all impressed with my kind of job career, what I chose to be. Like, you know, so I went back to Germany, and then actually I broke my back when I was there. My lower back, which nothing bad happened. I mean, I broke it and I had to be fused, but I was very lucky. My spinal cord didn't get damaged. And by then I couldn't gallop anymore, so I ended up working for an equine sports therapist in Germany who was actually Canadian, and I translated his seminars for him for about a year. So I learned a lot that way. It was very interesting, you know, equine, you know, massages and acupuncture and kind of different ways. So, and then from then, I read an, Hagar Davidson McGee, they advertised in the Irish Racing Post for veterinary assistants. So I'm like, oh, well, that sounds good. I can go to America for a few months and work there, which is what I did. It's just 9 months turned into now 18 years.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was in 98. So I worked, I went to Hagar Davidson McGee in the March of 98, I believe, and worked there until the winter. And then I worked, it was a 4 to midnight shift, which is a great shift to work for not. And I missed galloping. So then in the mornings I got up and galloped in Keeneland. And then in between, and then I went back in the afternoon, went back to work at the clinic, which is still, I still learned a lot. But then I decided this clinic is just not for me. I just miss the horses, riding the horses too much. And worked for some nice, good trainers. And eventually I decided I wanted to be a jockey. I think that was in 2001. Yeah. So, and that's...
Why horses, Anne? Are you from a horse racing family?
No, not at all. I don't know. It's just, no, not at all. I had a pony. I got an Icelandic horse when I was 9. So that's pretty much it. I just always liked horses. I don't know. And I, even after, you know, graduating high school, I just wanted to work with the horses. It's just what I love, I guess, you know, is what you love. And then once you're there, you can't leave it.
You said
I couldn't see myself doing anything else. And, you know, I tried, like, my parents, they, you know, like I said, they weren't very happy with what I chose and tried to get me ready. But, I mean, but they soon changed their minds. Once I started riding and I was, you know, doing good, they were pretty proud of me.
Of course. So, and you have siblings, I believe, yes? Did they follow your path?
Yes, they do. Yeah, well, I see, they're more like, they're both, both my brothers are physicians, like, so I don't know what went wrong with me. Something went wrong. I mean, I always tell them they're older. I was at the end of the food chain. I didn't get all the good stuff. I don't know. Vitamins and stuff. But, yeah, no, they're following me. They're also supportive and helpful and doing what they can. They're there too, so... Even now, like, my parents, you know, that I'm coping as I live by myself and I do everything on my own, pretty much. Well, what I can do, some things I can't, but I'm very independent. I've always been very independent. I'm glad I got, well, since some of last year I can drive, that I got that independence back too, that I don't rely on other people having to take me here and there. So that's pretty, you're always independent. It's hard. That was hard.
I can't
to ask other people and, you know, for this and that. And, yeah.
I can't imagine. That's fantastic to hear that you're able to drive now. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank goodness. Yeah. Also, my friends, I'm sure they were glad too. They would drive me all around the place.
That's awesome.
It's like, yeah.
Did your parents ever watch you ride?
They did. Yeah. They came. They visited me in Minnesota one time, and then they came down here to Phoenix one time too. So, and I was actually lucky enough; I got to win a couple of races while they were here too. So that's nice.
That's fantastic. But, you mentioned yeah. Minnesota, Canterbury, and Arizona Surf Paradise. Yeah. Where did you start?
Actually, I got my license in Tampa. I was there, and but it's like, you know, I mean, I got my license there, but I never had an agent all through my apprenticeship, and like I think just the last 5-6 years maybe I had an agent, because I always worked for a trainer in Canterbury, and I galloped for him, and then I rode for him, and then whatever I picked up on the side, a lot of the smaller barns, you know, small trainers, that's pretty much who I rode for. And then in the winter I never really knew where to go, so I mainly just galloped. I just didn't really know, I just went around, but I survived somehow. And eventually, and I think I came here 2006 to Phoenix in the winter, and I found my spot here for the winter, so that I kept coming back here between Minnesota and Minnesota and Phoenix in the winter.
Now, that's a lot of work. You mentioned you were your own agent, and maybe you mostly rode for one particular trainer, but still, that is a lot of work. Tell our listeners, what exactly is involved when it becomes to being your own agent?
Well, you just got to make sure, you know, I had a condition book where obviously the trainer I rode for, where he would enter his horses. And then if somebody else wanted, you know, that I, not somebody else that I, you know, would want to be put on a horse in the same race. But I didn't have that much business anyway, so it wasn't very difficult. And they all knew that I rode for my trainer, Mike Hansen, and then in the racing office too, so they knew that. So if anything would come up and I wasn't there, I'd leave a little, I write my horses and races, I would write them down on a piece of paper and hand them off to someone in the racing office and say, this is what I'm writing.
Hey, whatever works. And,
yeah, I mean, they worked with me, so that was nice, because I really didn't want to be at the draw. I needed a nap. I'm a big nap girl. I needed my nap.
That's awesome. You mentioned Vic Hansen, was he someone who really helped your career?
Yes, that's pretty much where I started riding. He's from South Dakota. And after I got my license in Tampa, somebody hooked me up with him, and that's where I went. And it was an experience. I was basically start riding Fort Pierce, South Dakota, which is a half-mile bull ring.
Oh, wow.
And, it was interesting. Yeah, I learned a lot. You learn how to toughen up, and it's a good thing I didn't know any better, because I don't know if I would have done it, you know, if I'd be more experienced. I learned a lot. It was an experience. And from there, then he would go to Canterbury, so I'd go to Canterbury with him. I think I worked for him for like 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah, 10 years. And then when I came here, and then I started working for Mike Chambers here. I pretty much always did better if I galloped for a barn and then they would ride me. I like that too. So you get to know your horses and they get to know you.
I was just going to say that I know when you know a horse before entering the starting gate, that's such an advantage.
Right, yeah. Especially at Vic's, because we had a bunch of two-year-olds. He did really good. And, I mean, I think that makes a big difference. Especially if you know them and they know you. So you know what they're going to do before they probably do it. And they know how you're going to react to certain things. And,
exactly.
Yeah. But, no, I enjoyed it. And you just get to know them. And you have more of a connection with your horse. When you get on him in the mornings and you know him from the barn and in the barn a bit more and just kind of jump on and off.
How many horses would you say you would gallop in the mornings before the races in the afternoon?
Oh, a lot. Probably between about 7, I think, sometimes more.
Wow.
I'd say average about 7, yeah. Yeah.
That had to help with your weight. Did you have to worry about your weight at all?
No, not at all. No, I was lucky. Yeah, no, I didn't have worries there.
That's too
funny. There was no worries there. It was funny, too, because it was when I started riding, because like I said, I got my license in Tampa, and over there they had a 10-pound bug, right? So I was really light. And then I went to South Dakota in the bushes, and when I started riding there, the races weren't even recognized. And everything was in at 126 probably, so, and I only weighed 106 probably.
Oh, wow.
And most of the jocks were overweight. And I was having a hard time. And they didn't recognize the bug there, so I had to pack full weight. Well, that was interesting. But it didn't. They're not used to, I'd only had a small saddle. You know, I just started riding, and I didn't need a big saddle. I had 10-pound bug. And they were trying to find enough lead for me to put everywhere so I could make weight.
Oh, my goodness. 20 pounds.
I know. And if I, yeah. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then especially the quarter horses, and they're so round, trying to put a lead pad on those and the saddle without it slipping, because they're like, that was like in the spring, and they would have quarter horse trials. Yeah, so that's the first time riding quarter horses, too. It was interesting. My trainer had a hard time sometimes saddling them and getting everything to stay in the middle.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. And then if I would win, they would, I mean, they were so on my case about making weight, making sure I had enough lead everywhere that I, you know, wasn't packing light because they were all overweight and they didn't like getting beat by me.
Oh, of course not. So, I didn't want to get beat by you. That fascinates me. South Dakota. How was it to ride with the other jockeys there? What did you learn?
Well, it's boring. So you pretty much, you learn how to ride tight. You learn how to ride the rail. And they were tough. And especially me you learn how to fuck her up. Because they didn't even have, I was the only girl there. They had no girl jocks room there. I mean, it was like 10. And then, I was just in with the guys. And it was,
So what did you do if there was no girls jocks room?
Well, I just get dressed at home.
Yeah. I mean,
change
beats
at home.
The alternative, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing else you can do, right? And, finally, I guess, later on, like when I first started, there was nothing. And then, I don't know, a couple years later, they finally found a spot for me on the other side of the grandstand where I could have my own little room.
Well, that's good. At least yeah. they finally yeah, did something, they, right?
Yeah, but they weren't used to it. There were no girls there. And, you know, and those guys, I mean, they were, like, older, and half of them were drunk and whatever. But,
oh, goodness.
But, you know, it was good because I learned a lot of stuff. To trust the pony person, because my trainer, he would, well, saddle a horse, he would pony me, and he would handle me in the gate. So right from the beginning, I learned how to trust him, and even later on, it helped me to know, you know, the assistant starter, I mean, they have me in the gate, and I shut up, and it's their job, you know, so, and it helped me a lot, too, that way, I would trust them.
If you were the only girl there, was it difficult to convince people? And you were early on in your career, especially when you first got there. Was it difficult to convince people that you could get the job done just as good as the boys?
No, it wasn't actually. No, they were right. No, it wasn't at all. No, because they seen too. And I mean, you know, that I did good. I mean, half the time, I still didn't know what I was doing, really, but I got them around there, and somehow I won, too. So. But then it's funny, because then a couple of other people, they went to Canterbury, and then they forgot all about me. Then, you know, then you're not good enough anymore. But when you get to the picture, that's the way it is. And, well, it's you know, it's upsetting and frustrating, but you learn. It's just the way it is.
Sure.
But...
You say you started out even back there in South Dakota riding quarter horses as well, and I have to tell you I've been on a quarter horse once in the morning working from the gate. That was the biggest adrenaline rush I've ever had in my life.
No, they're fun, aren't they?
Oh my gosh, you better be tied on. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
What?
Especially when they jump down. Yeah.
Exactly. What's the difference? Tell our listeners what's the difference between riding a thoroughbred and riding a quarter horse.
Well, I think quarter horses, also they react a lot different. Obviously, you're going much shorter distance, so you're out of the gate, and you got to go. You know, and if you don't, you know, you got to leave there. It's not like with a thoroughbred, you can, you know, if you don't break that good, well, if you're going longer, you can make up the ground a lot of times. And there's not much strategy riding a quarter horse. You know, you pretty much go, but you got to, you ride them different too. You got to make them run into the bit. You leave with shorter reins. Well, I used to anyway. And pretty much have them, you know, make them run into the bit the whole way. So, like the thing they're running off. You know, like with thoroughbreds, you have a loop in the reins when you're out the gate. Well, I never did that with quarter horses. Pretty much you leave a tighter rein, so they're pretty much out of the gate. You have them into the bit, running into the bit.
I did not know that. So, that is very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I just like him. I just like him. They're fun. But yeah, I remember because he got, actually, I qualified the first year there. We had three trials and I qualified two. And I beat him. It's funny because I beat the boys, even though, you know, they in the finals in the futurity there. And they just tell me, hang on and scream. I said, okay, I can do that. I just got my manual. I just go and I don't know. So that's funny.
Just get out and go, Anne.
Yep, pretty much.
Jockey Anne Von Rosen joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Anne, you left South Dakota, then you went to Canterbury. What was that like from going to pretty much you only rode at a bush track? What was the transition like going to Canterbury?
Oh, wow. It was like, you have to, your whole timing is out of whack going on around the half mile ring anyway, so pretty much. And the whole pacing thing, you have to, you know, how in the bull ring, you start riding on the backside pretty much. And you have to just, you know, really pace yourself going to the mile track. And like, you know, have to remember where you're at and not start riding too early and just wait. Have even more patience than, you know, before. We just, it's the stretch is so much longer. You got so much further to go still than on the bowling. So, but It wasn't too bad. You know, you learn. And especially when you gallop in workhorses there in the mornings, and then you get it. You sit. Sorry, my dog is right here. She's being a vulture.
How many dogs do you have, Ann?
Just one left. I used to have two. I have one left now, so.
What kind of a dog is she?
I don't know, some terrier mix thing.
Some terrier mix thing.
A couple years ago. Yeah, I don't really know what she is. She thinks she's awfully special.
Well, of course she is. Where did you get her?
I found her on the side of the road when I came back from work one morning, and she was running around on the road and close to the big road. And I figured, well, the way she was running around, she's not going to make it across the road. So I picked her up. And then nobody wanted her. Nobody claimed her. So
she's yours now.
So she found herself a home.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, going back to Canterbury, did anyone take you aside and kind of take you under their wing and show you the ropes?
I asked some of the older riders and stuff. Yeah. You know, they didn't really, like, come to me much. I just, you know, you have to ask. But I was, you know, so I just asked around and asked them to help me. And if they see me do some stupid stuff out there and stuff I can do better, to let me know. And then they're really helpful, you know. If they know you want to learn, well, you know, and are willing to learn, and they'll help you out.
You say stupid stuff out there. What were the things?
Well, you know, like things you shouldn't do, and, you know, like be more aware of where you're at and check before you know, all that stuff.
What were the...
Basically, ride responsibly.
Sure. What were the things that you had to work on the most?
I had to work on my patience. I know that. And then, yeah, don't get, you know, and just wait and be impatient and not be too, you know. Yeah, I think so. And just aware. I think that's, yeah, my patience, I guess.
How would you describe your riding style as you developed from a younger rider? You lost the bug. You moved to Canterbury. How would you describe your riding style?
I don't know. Like, what do you mean exactly? Like, my riding style?
Were you come from behind jockey? Were you a strong finisher?
Well, I think from coming from the bull ring, I was used to speed horse. You know, from the bull ring, you want to go to the front. And then in the beginning, I rode so many two-year-olds, and the trainer, also because he trained quarter horse too, he liked you to be out there. So I think in the beginning, I was definitely more of a speed rider, just because that's what we always did, and that's what my instructions were. So,
makes sense.
And then later on, it changed. I got more, you know, I was supposed to have rode for. I let the horse later on, so I was a trainer here, I rode for, be more comfortable wherever he's comfortable, and then take it from there. Whereas in the beginning, I was definitely more of a speed rider. But then I think it changed.
So I have
changed a lot more.
I have to tell you, Ann, when I started riding, and I told you I worked a quarter horse from the gate, and I did that because I was having difficulties breaking from the gate sharply. I wasn't very good at it back in the beginning. You had to be good at that, coming from the bull ring. Describe to our listeners, and it's a very particular way to do that properly. Describe to our listeners how you get a horse to break sharply from the gate.
You have to be alert. They take you out anyway. You just got to be ready for them. You know, I would stare down into the V of the front of the starting gates, and but they know too, and the starter makes sure, you know, whoever handles you on the gate, that they aware, and they are pointed, and they're looking left or right, that they're paying attention. And then you just got to be ready and go with them with the horse. You know, I have my mane hold, and some move in the rein. And when they go, I mean, I would just go. But they take you. I mean, I was lucky, I guess. I don't know. I've always been pretty good at that. And I would just, you know, they take me with them. And so.
Get tied on, Ann. We only have a couple minutes left. But then, from Canterbury, eventually you moved to Turf Paradise in the winters. Describe that track to us.
prefer it. Well, it's very different to Canterbury. The surface is different. The backside is different. The whole atmosphere is different. But it's good, even especially for girls down here, because like I didn't. Well, I knew some trainers here because a lot of trainers from here go to Canterbury. But if they see you work in the morning and they'll give you, you know, and they'll put you on horses and they see you try in the afternoon, they will ride you. You know, all you got to do is try, especially a lot of the small trainers, and give them a fair, honest ride, and they'll give you a shot. And I like that here. You know, all the places, they won't even give you a shot, but they see you trying and you're honest, and they give you give them a fair ride, and you try hard for them, even if they are, you know, 40 to 1, 50 to 1. Then they'll give you a shot, and eventually you get better horses, too. That's why I liked it here, too.
Were there other girls riding there at the time?
Yes, yeah, there were. There've always been quite a few girls here. I mean, I think the most, yeah, a lot more than in Canterbury. So, yeah, there've always, yeah. And, as you know, we all get along good in the room, too. It's pretty good. It was pretty good atmosphere. It was small, not as big. We were pretty crowded, but it's good, yeah.
Well, it had to
and
be.
And there were plenty enough horses to get around, give up, you know, for everyone.
Well, it had to beat the little room on the other side of the grandstand they gave you at South Dakota, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wasn't spoiled, that's for sure.
And
even having a valet, because in South, you know, in the Buddha Shrine, you don't have a valet. You got to do everything yourself. So.
And we only have about a minute left. I just want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day to join us and to wish you all the best in the future.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much. I guess I appreciate you having me. And, that all this stuff, you get donated to the PDJF, because unfortunately there's quite a few of us out here that rely on the PDJF. So it's a great cause, and I really thank you for that.
Check it out, www.pdjf.org. And if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. You'll also find a full schedule for every show on the Horse Racing Radio Network on our website. We bring you something new almost every day of the week. Check it out, horseracingradio.net. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal. Thank you for listening.